The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Signals.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you find Christians to be so judgmental. And in doing so, don't they violate the Bible's command to not judge? You know that the Bible says to not judge. In fact, you can even quote the verse. You may not know where it's found, but you've heard it many times. Judge not, lest you be judged. Not only have you memorized it, you've memorized it in King James. Well, my friend, that verse is in the Bible. It's found in the 7th chapter of Matthew, but it's often taken out of context. In fact, it's not even the only verse in the Bible about judging. Elsewhere in Scripture, you'll be interested to know, Christians are commanded to make judgments. Now, that shouldn't surprise us. Everybody makes judgments. In fact, the moment you say it's wrong to judge, do you realize you have just issued a judgment? What else would you call it? The moment you say it's wrong to judge, you have called something wrong. That's an appraisal. That's an assessment. That's a judgment. And so, since all of us make judgments, the only relevant question is, what exactly are we judging? Does this particular practice warrant a good appraisal or a bad appraisal, a good judgment or a bad judgment? Now, having said that, you are still partly right. There is a kind of judgment that the Bible forbids. But again, there is another kind of judgment that the Bible commands. We will discuss this stimulating topic later on in today's program. But first, speaking of judgments, our United States courts have made several critical judgments lately. For starters, a 3-panel committee of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has supported the lower court ruling against Proposition 8. And this has been going on for several years now. Time for some review. At first, the people of California passed a law, goes back years now, California passed a law stating that marriage would be defined as a union between a man and a woman. That's the way it always had been defined anyway, but people were starting to define it differently. They were trying to change the law. So the people in California attempted a, I guess you'd call it a preemptive strike. Marriage means a union between a man and a woman. Where did they ever get a nutty idea like that? Then, as is usually the case, a court overturned the law, claiming it was unconstitutional. So what did the people of California do? They said, well, if it's really unconstitutional, which it really wasn't, but they figured, well, let's make the Constitution more clear. We will change the Constitution. It'll be written in those words in the Constitution. How can a judge ignore that? So later on, in 2008, after some 7 million people passed Proposition 8, the California Constitution was actually changed. Now, my radio show was on the air back in 2008. I went on the air at that point predicting that some judge would find the amended Constitution unconstitutional. Insane as that sounds. Now, I said it in a way that sounded sarcastic, but I was also half serious. Well, people, that is just exactly what happened. A federal judge then declared the California Constitution to be unconstitutional, that is in serious conflict with the federal constitution, which incidentally says that our independent states have a right to make their own constitutions. The rationale of this judge was that the state constitution violates federal rights, which must transcend all states and be true for all Americans, namely the promise for equal protection under the law. Well, if the Supreme Court upholds this brilliant reasoning, it will have to explain why plural marriage is not also a candidate for equal protection. Meanwhile, the will of some 7 million Californians was traded in for the opinion of one judge. Democracy, hard at work. That 7 million opinions not being tolerated in the name of tolerance. And now a panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld this lower judge's decision. Look, whatever a person's view of gay marriage, I would think they'd find this a disturbing trend that a few individuals are overturning democratic decisions. Yes, this will end up in the United States Supreme Court, and we don't know yet how the Supreme Court will rule, but we do know that such decision-making is now in the sole hands of our judiciary. People, let me say this as nicely as I can. If you believe in same-sex marriage, I respect your view, and I respect you as a person. I do. I'm serious. I disagree with your view, but I respect you. Now, can you say the same of me? Maybe you can, maybe. But I know that in the mainstream media, people with my position are painted as bigots, idiots, hate mongers. That view is also coming from many of our college campus professors. We're told there's nothing to even debate, nothing to even discuss. This, again, in the name of tolerance. Now, one of the concerns of conservatives had to do with our public schools. Proposition 8 advocates warned that if gay marriage remained the law of the land, schools might be forced to talk approvingly about the subject in sexual education or other classes. Opponents of Proposition 8 replied swiftly, saying you're worrying about the slippery slope. They painted the conservatives as a group of paranoid fear mongers. In fact, I'll give you an example. There was a television ad, and in this ad, Jack O'Connell, the state superintendent of public instruction, spoke, and he spoke with considerable passion. He said, and I'm quoting him, Proposition 8 has nothing to do with schools or kids. Our schools are not required to teach anything about marriage, and using kids to lie about that is shameful. So, okay, well, what ended up happening in 2011? Something they said would never happen? Senate Bill 48 passed in Sacramento. What is Senate Bill 48? A new law insisting that history teaching in all public schools, all of them, no matter what the age, history classes must include discussions of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Now, we're talking about a bill created by Senator Mark Leno, who said on his own website, now I'm quoting him, Senate Bill 48 would ensure that our history books fairly and accurately include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Really? Oh boy, I pity the poor teacher who dares to assume that a negative portrayal of a gay historical figure is a fair and accurate one. You think this is paranoia again? My friend, if that's how you feel, maybe you should lie down for a while until the feeling goes away, because this is serious stuff. It's happening around us. Actually, that bill merely updates an existing law that prohibits, and I'm quoting the law, prohibits a governing board from adopting instructional materials that contain any matter reflecting adversely upon persons because of their race, color, creed, national origin, ancestry, sex, handicap, or occupation, or that contain any sectarian or denominational doctrine or propaganda contrary to law. Okay, that was the law. That law was updated. Now the end of the list reads gender, religion, disability, nationality, and sexual orientation. And so one is not allowed to speak negatively about homosexuality, but in addition, they must proactively discuss gay historical figures. This means they have to discuss them with approval of their lifestyle. How else can you add that up? Now, in some schools, all over the states, not just California, all over the states, discussions of homosexuality are taught in a variety of classes, not simply history. We'll see much more in the future. And here to tell you all about it is our own Smiley Miley.
Hey, kids. Do you know what makes America such a great country? Family. That's right, family. Each and every one of you belongs to a family, even if you don't like your family very much. And families are as American as apple pie, baseball, and hot dogs. Of course, baseball is a chauvinistic sport because women don't play in the World Series, and apple pie has too much sugar and is not as good for you as carrot cake or quiche. And hot dogs are not very good for you either, unless you call them Frankfurters. And remember that the Frankfurter is really a German food. German food is good to eat because Germany is a different culture, and anything from a culture different than our culture is always good, even if Germany is a Western culture, and therefore not as good of a culture as a third world culture. But back to families. Just as there are different kinds of cultures, there are different kinds of families. Some of you have mommies and daddies who love you. Some of you have sisters and brothers who hate you. Some of you have grandmas and grandpas who watch you for the weekend when mommies and daddies need a break and want to get away from you. These kinds of families are familiar. But did you know that new kinds of families are forming these days? That's right, brand new families. And some of these families are more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Sooner or later, one of your little playmates will tell you that instead of a mommy and a daddy, they have two mommies or two daddies. This may look unusual, especially if you see the two mommies kissing or the two daddies cuddling on the couch while watching a football game. But even though these new families look unusual, they are actually very, very normal. Anyone who thinks two mommies are not as good as a mommy and a daddy is a fascist. Can you spell fascist? Fascist begins with an F, and an F is what you will get as a grade if you disagree with your teachers when they teach you that two mommies are normal. But it's not just a matter of spelling the word. Do you know what a fascist is? A fascist is one who believes in nasty dictators, or nasty kings, or nasty generals. These nasty rulers tell people what to do, and tell people what to think, and those who don't obey the rulers go to jail. Do you like jail? Then don't be a fascist. Now, some of you are wondering, what if I become a fascist by accident? After all, I didn't know that two ladies kissing was normal. Nobody told me that before. Don't worry. At least you heard about it today, and you heard about it in time. And we'll continue helping you each and every day by telling you what to do and telling you what to think about mommies and daddies. Someday this won't be a problem anymore. Someday it will be against the law to call something abnormal. And once we arrest those who break this law, we will keep ourselves from becoming a fascist country and remain the good old-fashioned American country we've always been. Because once again, family is as American as apple pie, hot dogs, and, well, you get the idea. That's all, kids. Have fun with your families.
Call Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll-free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
The sound. You're more beautiful.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Once again, some appellate judges have made a ruling which overthrows the will of voting citizens. Such magistrates should be honored during this year's Academy Awards show. After all, it can't be easy for them to maintain a straight face while pretending to uphold democracy. With most Americans looking westward at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals' recent ruling about Proposition 8 in California, a January ruling from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals concerning an Oklahoma case has slipped off the radar. I'm not seeing it on any of our news commentary programs. But I am reading from the Los Angeles Times. It's already dated, but not too old. It's from last month, but I'm betting that most of you have not heard about this. Okay, Los Angeles Times. And the Los Angeles Times, that's not a paper that's really, they're not too sympathetic to conservative concerns, but they're reporting this. They said the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, in a ruling released Tuesday, affirmed an order by a district court judge in 2010 that prevented the voter-approved state constitutional amendment from taking effect. The ruling also allows a Muslim community leader in Oklahoma City to continue his legal challenge of the law's constitutionality. Okay, so it means that, again, something was added to a constitution, a judge overthrew it. What were they trying to say in the constitution? They were trying to say that Oklahoma can never have Sharia law or international law because judges are now starting to talk about doing that. So, okay, let me go back to the article and read it in their words. They give you the details of this. The measure, known as State Question 755, was approved with 70% of the vote in 2010. The amendment would bar courts from considering the legal precepts of other nations or cultures. Specifically, the courts shall not consider international law or Sharia law, the law reads. The appellate court opinion pointed out that proponents of the law admitted to not knowing of a single instance in which an Oklahoma court applied Sharia law or the legal precepts of other countries. This serves as a reminder that these anti-Sharia laws are unconstitutional and that if politicians use fear-mongering and bigotry, the courts won't allow it to last for long, said Munir Awad, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Oklahoma. Awad sued to block the law, contending that it infringed on his First Amendment rights. Okay, so are you catching this? The state of Oklahoma gets together, and some would say, well, if our Constitution already says that it has to be American law, why are they doing this? Because they're looking at what's happening around them. They're putting into their Constitution that we can't have Sharia law. Sharia law is a religious law that Muslims live under. It varies from country to country. And so what's happening is these people were being accused of fear-mongering. The accusation is, well, we haven't had a case yet in Oklahoma where there was Sharia law, so why are they getting so freaked out about it? That's the idea here. Fear-mongering. Fear-mongering. Let me ask a question. Is it possible, just remotely possible, that people in Oklahoma are exhibiting genuine fear rather than manipulative fear-mongering? Could they be swimming upstream to avoid a problem before it flows through? Maybe they heard about that Muslim gentleman in New Jersey who initially avoided a restraining order in the name of Sharia law, even though his wife, his ex-wife, accused him of rape. Yes, I'm reading now from Fox News back in August 2010. A New Jersey family court judge's decision not to grant a restraining order to a woman who was sexually abused by her Moroccan husband and forced repeatedly to have sex with him is sounding the alarm for advocates of laws designed to ban Sharia in America. Judge Joseph Charles, in denying the restraining order to the woman after her divorce, ruled that her ex-husband felt he had behaved according to his Muslim beliefs and that he did not have criminal desire to or attempt to sexually assault his wife. That was from Fox News. Now, it's true. It's true. Good news. An appellate court overturned this New Jersey case. But people, one would think that such a cozy relationship between judicial activism and certain segments of Islam would send chills up our spines, even at a lower court level. Meanwhile, I remind you that Oklahoma experiences the ruling of a higher court level. Of course, politically correct America already knows by heart the standard response to such expressed concern. Well, many Muslims are peaceful. They're peaceful, and therefore it is unfair to characterize an entire religion with a few bad apples. All right, true enough. But here's the thing. most concerned citizens are not denying the existence of peaceful Muslims. Instead, they are affirming the existence of a document fast on its way to antiquity, our United States Constitution. Of course, judicial activism has been a frequent theme on my program. I feel the need today to review this again before our country finds itself on a road without any turns. So I'm going to go back a little bit. I remember a few years ago receiving a comment from an atheist regarding my op-ed piece of December 4th, 2009 for the San Diego Newsroom. In arguing about what our Constitution's Establishment Clause meant, he reacted to my statement about the original tent of our forefathers. I had said in my article, what the Constitution meant to them is what the Constitution means, period. My reader responded, let me read him, totally, hopelessly wrong. What the Constitution means is what the Supreme Court says it means, period. Reading the minds of the likes of Thomas Jefferson may be within your abilities, but I'd like to see proof. People, I hope you're paying serious attention to this. In my article, I mentioned that in the days of our forefathers, religious shrines were all over public land. That doesn't tell us anything about the minds of the forefathers as far as what the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, means. Neither do the diaries of the men. We have all kinds of diaries. It's impossible to know from reading the actual words of Jefferson and reading the actual words of Adams how they felt. But the often arbitrary, often emotional interpretation of the Supreme Court tells us everything we need to know about Jefferson and Adams. The words of our forefathers and the actions of our forefathers do not explain their own words, but the nine justices appointed by politicians with biases and litmus tests do explain their words. To anyone who thinks the Supreme Court has a perfect, exclusively authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you. Dred Scott decision, where the wise, insightful legal scholars ruled that African slaves were property. Still care to point to that court as a superior, unquestioned power? Newsflash, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Let me say that again, because you did hear me correctly. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere. Don't bother looking. You won't find it. Or I'll tell you what. Go ahead. Bother looking. See for yourself that you won't find it. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution. We'll talk more about the Supreme Court when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Before we went to the break, I said, and I know some of you are still holding on to your chairs, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. I know that flies against everything you hear. I said the purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution. Now, in all likelihood, many listeners are raising their eyebrows about now, even fellow conservatives, even people who sympathize with public reaction against judicial activism. Maybe what I'm saying sounds too good to be true. Maybe what I'm saying sounds too bizarre to be true. Certainly, this position is out of the mainstream at our present time in history. I realize that. If you ask most Americans, they would say it is absolutely, indeed, of course, the job of the Supreme Court to interpret our founding document. And so would most lawyers, and certainly a good many judges. Yet some legal scholars would agree with me. Others might answer delicately, as law professor and talk show host Hugh Hewitt did when I interviewed him a few years ago back in 05 on my program. Asked if the Constitution never intended for the Supreme Court to interpret it, Hugh Hewitt said carefully, "It can be so argued." Now, throughout history, majority opinion has often been wrong. So you can go out and count up how many people tell you otherwise. But we don't determine truth by the majority. We determine truth by examining the facts. I remind you, most people in the world accepted slavery for the greater balance of human history, including, once again, the Supreme Court itself. But I won't belabor that point. And so perhaps we would be well served to temporarily ignore public opinion and instead examine the testimony of facts from the past. Take with your old pal Bob a trip down memory lane, America memory lane. The interpretation tradition began when Thomas Jefferson, who was only our third president, refused to install some justices that John Adams, our second president, John Adams had appointed these justices before he left office, and Jefferson refused to install them. Since the judges were appointed, but then we changed presidents before they were officially inaugurated, so Jefferson said, heck, well, if they were never inaugurated, I wouldn't have chosen them, and so he didn't feel obligated to use them. As a result, his government was sued in a landmark case called Marbury versus Madison, 1803. Now, that is a very important case to law schools. They'll still talk about this case as a turning point. They will. Because this unusual situation had never come up in such a high-level, complicated scenario. And for that reason, litigation turned to the Supreme Court, which ordered Jefferson via his Secretary of State, James Madison, to appear before them and explain themselves. That's why it's called Marbury versus Madison. Now, they were ordered to go to the court and explain. Jefferson just ignored them. He'd ignored them. Now, Marbury, one of those justices spurned by Jefferson, referred to the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a basis for the court being able to issue such commands. The Judiciary Act had mentioned that the Supreme Court overrules other courts, but they were unclear as to the procedure, which courts they should go to first. But anyway, they had passed a law, and they call that law the Judiciary Act of 1789. Marbury is now quoting the Judiciary Act as an excuse to sue Thomas Jefferson and say, hey, I should be appointed as a justice. Now, ironically, the court, after first showing sympathy to Marbury, pronounced a contradictory ruling and ruled with Jefferson. The court decided that the Judiciary Act was unconstitutional because it gave the Supreme Court more power than the Constitution intended. Can you imagine that? The Supreme Court ruling that they had too much power? So even though the justices were sympathetic to Marbury and insisted the law set up by Congress was on his side, they ultimately ruled against him by deeming that same act of Congress to be technically unconstitutional. Marbury, according to the high justices, should have started with a lower court rather than the ultimate court in the land, and therefore they could not issue the verdict that both they and he wanted. This decision was actually a political stroke of genius under the leadership of Chief Justice John Marshall, who found a way to lecture and chastise his rival Jefferson without giving the very popular president an actual court order that Jefferson would certainly refuse to obey anyway, making Marshall look like an idiot. In short, Marshall devised a clever strategy to save face by having his cake and eating it too. Nevertheless, be that as it may, in calling an act of Congress unconstitutional for giving too much power to the court, this landmark ruling established a tradition about the Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution intended. Gotta see the irony. Now, here's what's really interesting. Jefferson disagreed with the court's newfound powers, even though in this particular instance, the ruling was personally convenient, as now he did not have to appoint the justices. But Jefferson feared that if this understanding of judicial power accepted, it would be, and I'm quoting the words of Thomas Jefferson, it would be placing us under the despotism of an oligarchy. You know what an oligarchy is? It means rule by judges. Unfortunately, 1803 spawned a custom that we as a nation never quite shook. It established what is commonly called case law. And yes, law schools teach and generally accept case law. I am convinced this is based upon a mistake grandfather clause into a tradition that has taken on a life of its own. Today, we live in the debris of that fateful Marbury versus Madison ruling. Not only the Supreme Court, but other courts along the way. Along that ladder, they make decisions to overturn the will of the people or the laws passed by Congress. These recent examples of Sharia law in Oklahoma and the will of the people overturned in California are amongst the most frightening of all. Now, I don't mean any disrespect for the honorable profession of magistrates. The Supreme Court is our third branch of government. It has an important role to play. We need checks and balances. When unusual situations arise, it falls upon the courts to apply our Constitution. I suspect that's what many people mean anyway when they use the word interpret. But, and let me say this as carefully as I can, it is a false idea that judges can legislate from the bench with unchecked power over the other two branches of government, free to overturn laws at will. Such usurping of authority was the farthest thing from the minds of our forefathers. The Constitution is a clearly written document. It had to be. It had to be. The authors knew a whole country would be governed by it. They did not wish to confuse us. They did not write in riddles or parables. Neither is it poetry or symbolism. If we know how to read, we do not need anyone to tell us what it means. With all due homage to those who graduated law school, I have a message for everyone else. You do not have to be a lawyer to comprehend the Constitution. Now, many people will challenge you for having such brass, but Thomas Jefferson will be on record agreeing with you. You're not in bad company.
To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. If you'd like to weigh in on any of the things we're discussing today, our call-in number, as always, 888-344-1170. Many people today contacting me through Facebook, Twitter, or directly over the internet, questions at bobsiegel.net. That's questions at BobSiegel.net. And writing me through questions at BobSiegel.net, Diane says, no question, great show. Just want to thank you for your ministry, your radio show. I stay up too late listening on Saturday nights and need to find another time to catch your show. God bless you and your work. Well, thank you very much, Diane, for your kind words about the program. I think I have some good news for you. When you listen on Saturday nights at 11 o'clock p.m., you are actually listening to a rebroadcast from the previous Sunday. The live program airs very early Sunday evenings from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, or right now, as we like to say in the studio. You can also listen to as many posted shows as you wish off of my website at your convenience. You can download them to your iPod. We have podcasts. You can listen to it while you're jogging. So who knows? Right now, as I speak in this live studio broadcast, it is the 6 o'clock show, but maybe Diane will be listening next Saturday night, which means from her point of view, I said this a week ago, but I'll be on again tomorrow. Ah, radio, it challenges the fabric of our space-time continuum. Regarding some comments I made last week where I insisted that abortion was a human rights issue, not merely a religious issue, with that human embryo being the one in need of rights, Frederick says, dear Mr. Siegel, kudos for, and then he quotes something I said, kudos for saying one need not be religious to recognize a human being. I would be delighted if you would examine and hopefully read Champion of Women and the Unborn, my biography of the Boston pro-life physician Horatio Robinson Storer, MD, Harvard. Now, Frederick goes on to say that this non-religious doctor converted to Catholicism as a result of his study of the human fetus. That's very interesting. So he started out secular, recognized human rights, and then became religious. It didn't happen the other way. He didn't do it because he was religious. Well, Frederick, thank you for those encouraging words. I would be happy to read your book. Now we have a few responses here from Facebook. Renee says, what's amazing to me, and he agrees, and he's angry, but he agrees, he's concerned. What's amazing to me is that judges, whether elected or appointed, are sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution. What the F? There's an F with all kinds of other little typewritten signals next to it. I think we all know what he means by the F. You don't need me to explain it, right? And if I did explain it, the FCC would be here, and we wouldn't want them here. So we'll just settle for what the F are they thinking by going against the will of the people and upholding Sharia law, the Quran, and other forms of anti-constitutional documents? These activist judges need to be recalled, replaced. Well, some of them have lifetime appointments. Some of them don't. Our Supreme Court justices do. Anyway, continue with Renee. These activist judges need to be recalled, replaced, and sent to Saudi Arabia with a suitcase full of Bibles. After all, the Saudis are so tolerant about the possession of Bibles. Yeah, if a Muslim converts to Christianity in Saudi Arabia, they are executed. And these other countries lecture the United States about tolerance. It makes your head spin. But that's my commentary. I need to get back to Renee. Renee says, as my friend Dennis Miller used to say, I didn't know you were friends with Dennis Miller, Renee. Well, I like Dennis Miller. Help me get him on my show, Renee. Okay, anyway. As my friend Dennis Miller used to say, that's just my opinion. I could be wrong. Renee, you're not wrong. Now, Maureen on Facebook says, Bob, Sharia law is an integral part of Islam, which means that even the nicest, most peaceful Muslims support Sharia law. Well, Maureen, it is true that any Muslim who understands his faith supports Sharia law. You're right about that. But there are nominal Muslims, people who grew up in Muslim countries, were born Muslims, who never really understood it, never really read the Quran. They don't even know their own faith. And I have made that clarification in previous radio shows, previous articles I've written about Islam. But generally, Maureen, it sounds like you and I are on the same page. Now, this next comment on Facebook is from Robert. Robert says, the law of the land, the United States Constitution, two exclamation points. He says, I get a bit miffed when someone is invited into my home and tells me I have to change it because he doesn't like it. Maybe he should go to a Muslim country where it is practiced. This next comment on Facebook is from Robert Jr. They both have the same last name. I'm not reading their last name. I have to assume then that Robert Jr. is Robert's son, and Robert Jr. has a whole different take than dear old dad. He says, there's no reason for a law outlawing Sharia in the U.S. So he's saying the people in Oklahoma didn't need to do it. He says the Constitution governs our country. End of story. That's his point. We don't need that. We already have our Constitution. Okay, Robert, I wish it were the end of the story, Robert. I wish that with all my heart. I partially agree. I would say there should be no reason for a new law. But as I mentioned, some judges are starting to use Sharia in their ruling. With judicial activism run amok, I can understand why people want to put specific clarifications into their state constitutions. In any event, a state law that merely affirms a federal law cannot be constitutional. How exactly is that unconstitutional? Some other comments. Our friend with the nickname Grouchy never fails to write. Grouchy says there is something unseemly about a religion with a law that reflects that religion, asking you to change your law to reflect their religious law. We didn't ask them to come to the USA. They asked to be admitted. But then Jim says pretty much a silly argument. Now, who's he calling silly? Me. Bob. He's calling me silly. He's saying I gave a silly argument. I know it's hard for you to accept, but somebody's disagreeing with me now. Pretty much a silly argument. I like our U.S. Constitution, and application of it by the courts is what we Americans have agreed to. So overturning acts of legislature or referendum that violate our U.S. Constitution is a good thing. Yeah, Jim. Yeah, that was pretty silly of me to be concerned about the kind of judicial thinking that refuses a restraining order on an ex-husband whose wife accused him of rape, all in the name of Sharia law. What, oh, what could have come over me, Jim? And since there is no Sharia law in our Constitution, how is the overturning of a state constitution's amendment, which would merely agree with the U.S. Constitution, something to be deemed unconstitutional? Jim, my friend, that makes zero sense. By the way, Jim, not all of we Americans have agreed to the way judicial activists apply our Constitution. Some of us understand by actually reading the Constitution, by actually studying the original tent of our forefathers, some of us understand what the Constitution says without some judge explaining to us what it means. Once again, our judicial branch is there to enforce, not to legislate from the bench. Well, as we move into the theology portion of our program, we continue the discussion of judgment, but now a whole different kind of judgment, judgment discussed in the Bible. I'm reading to you from Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. Now, 1 through 2 are very familiar to people. I mentioned at the top of the program, this is the favorite verse of people. I don't mean people that aren't Christians, but people that have some adversarial feelings toward Christianity, people who have some problems with the Bible. They love this verse. They don't know where it's found. They don't know its context, but they love to quote it, and we will look at it when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you. talking today about judging. And before we went to the break, I said that this is the favorite verse of people who have trouble with the Bible, particularly when they meet a Christian who does evangelism and they're sharing that Jesus is the only way to God and they don't like hearing that. So they'll go, hey, man, you're judging me and you're actually disobeying Jesus. And they'll quote this verse found in Matthew chapter 7, starting with verse 1. Do not judge or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. People love this verse in the Bible because they think it trumps all other verses in the Bible, except maybe one of those verses about God being real lovey-dovey or something like that. But let's look at this in context. Jesus continues to talk, and he now compares judging people with removing something from their eye. He says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? See, Jesus could be quite humorous and quite sarcastic. It's a big plank, a big wooden beam in their own eye. It would make quite a humorous sight. Somebody has a big piece of wood in their eye, which is, would really be impossible, but just for the sake of this analogy, and yet they're concerned about somebody else's splinter. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Folks, Jesus is not saying here that we can never judge. He's saying we cannot judge if we don't first judge ourselves. The Bible says all of us are sinners. If I were to say, I'm a sinner, but you're not, then I would be doing the kind of judgment Jesus forbids. If I judge myself a sinner, I'm allowed to share the gospel and say, hey, the same God who forgave me of my sin will forgive you of your sin. If the person wants to say, well, you're judging me because you're calling me a sinner, I could say, well, yeah, I guess that's technically true. I don't mean anything personal by it. The Bible says we're all sinners. My sin may not be the same as yours, but we've all sinned. We're all in the same boat. But see, people think that Christians are coming across as holier than thou and arrogant. I think a lot of times that's a mistake of Christians. We have to be careful about the way we say things. And I like to tell people right up front, I'm not claiming I'm better than you. I'm not claiming I've figured out something you haven't. I'm not claiming to be righteous and that you're unrighteous. I am a sinner who's forgiven. You can be a sinner who's forgiven. I am just one beggar telling another beggar where the bread is. But you got to go back and look at this. Jesus is not saying you can't take the splinter out of your brother's eye. Look at his words again. You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye. First, see, there's a process. First, take the plank out of your own eye. Then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Is he telling us we can't remove the speck? No, he's telling us we can't remove the speck until we've removed the beam. Now, I had a very fun conversation. This took place out at Mesa Community College, which was one of the first places I did campus ministry. That's Mesa, Arizona. And we would set up a book table, but we would also have Bible studies. Some of them were informal. And of course, weather's quite hot, or in the wintertime, at least mild in Arizona. So sometimes we'd have our Bible studies out on the lawn, only three or four people. So we didn't think we were making much of a ruckus. And one day, the lady who was in charge of the MU, the student union, college staff, she walked by my book table, and she was nice, she was friendly, but she says, excuse me, we are going to have to ask that your students not pray anymore when you have those Bible studies on the lawn. Well, the first thing I'm thinking of is, oh, well, we've probably been too loud. I said, oh, I'm sorry. Are we praying too loud? Are we being a disturbance? She goes, oh, no, no. No, you're not too loud. In fact, we can't even hear you. I said, well, then what's the problem? She says, well, people are seeing you with your eyes closed and your head bowed, and they find it offensive. I said, well, I find it offensive when people swear or use Jesus' name in a vain way. I would never deny their constitutional right to swear. She says, well, we have to keep our church and state separate. Now, that was never the intention, a separation between church and state, folks. For one thing, as I've said many times, those words are not in the Constitution anywhere. What the Constitution says is Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting its free exercise. This was a case where somebody was prohibiting the free exercise of our religion. Now, where am I going with the story? It does get back to this judging thing, because I immediately made an appointment to talk with the dean of students. Now, I've gone through this before in all the years I've done campus ministry. When I need to talk to a dean, I find that a lot of times when I get to the dean or the principal or the chancellor or the person in charge, they're usually the nicest people in the world. But sometimes there are secretaries that run interference. They take their job a little too seriously. I think that's a very respectable job, being a secretary. But when she starts doing things that go beyond the parameters of what she was hired to do, and they run interference, like not making the appointment that they're supposed to make, that's what you do when you're a secretary. That's one of the things, you make an appointment. So I walked in, and I could tell this woman knew me. It's a pretty small campus. Word had probably gotten around. I came and I said, excuse me, I'd like to make, and if I say so myself, I believe I was being quite pleasant with her. I said, excuse me, I would like to make an appointment with the dean. She goes, what do you want to talk to the dean for? And I'm going, ooh, we're having a problem here. I said, well, they're telling us we can't pray. And we believe we have a right to pray. We do not believe this violates the Constitution. Here's how she responded. She goes, well, didn't our Lord say, now before I even get into what she said our Lord said, okay, you see this? She's putting out some signal to me. She's saying, hey, I'm a Christian. In fact, I'm a more spiritual Christian than you, because I'm honestly obeying the Lord. Well, didn't our Lord say that we should pray in secret and never do things out in public? I said, well, at that time, Jesus was talking about a group of people called the Pharisees who were bragging about their religiosity. Their whole purpose for praying was to show off. But Jesus did pray in front of his disciples, in front of crowds often. When he gave the Lord's Prayer, he even gave an example of praying. And in the beginning of the book of Acts, chapter 2, the apostles were out in the streets. They were praying and singing and worshiping, and thousands became Christians. She said, oh. Okay, again, the example here is that people are taking things out of context. By the way, I talked to the dean. She was the nicest person in the world. And when I left Mesa College 2 years later and moved to Santa Barbara, the Christians were still praying. Now, that was well over 20 years ago. We know how politically correct the college campus. That's how bad it was back then. Can you imagine what it's like today? So I don't know if they're praying today. I hope so. But they were praying when your old pal Bob was out there. Well, that's an example of taking things out of context. Again, of course, this judge not lest you be judged is another one that gets taken out of context. Well, on this same college, Mesa, I had a conversation with a Jehovah's Witness. Now, we could have a whole conversation about Jehovah's Witnesses. They are people that They have a very unusual take on the Bible. They ignore some of its plain teachings. They deny that Jesus was actually God. Not important for this discussion. It's a very important issue, but I've spent whole shows proving from the scriptures that Jesus was God. Point is, the Jehovah's Witness and I were arguing about it. Now, not everybody I meet on the campus thinks arguing is a four-letter word. It was a friendly argument. It was a friendly discussion. I found that often two of us could be arguing and some third party comes by and gets offensive. And boy, when it's a Christian, when it's a self-righteous, sickeningly sweet, smiley Christian that gets all freaked out because we're arguing, like arguing isn't in the spirit of Jesus. You know how many times Jesus argued with the Pharisees? Apollos, who was discipled by Paul, says he went into the synagogues, argued with the Jews day and night from the scriptures. Paul did the same thing. I mean, this is crazy. Everybody thinks Jesus guy just went around smiling, oh, I love you, brother, like he was somebody out of the 60s. That's not Jesus. Sometimes Jesus argued, sometimes he didn't feel he needed to argue because people were so beaten up about their sins, he didn't want to give them a hard time. But anyway, this guy came by, and I could tell he was concerned that we were arguing. So he starts looking through the Bible, and I'm talking to my Jehovah's Witness friend, and I'm watching this other guy out the corner of my eye, and I could tell that he's looking for a verse, and he's suddenly getting frustrated because he can't find it. And I could just tell he wanted to quote this verse because he was going to rebuke both of us for arguing. Finally, in a fit of frustration, he slammed the Bible. This was just a Bible he had on the table. He slammed it back down and walked off in a huff. Okay, now, I can't read minds. I don't know this for sure. But if I had money to bet in Las Vegas, I'm almost positive this is what happened. He was going to show us in the Bible, judge not, lest you be judged. Because it was practically the only verse in the Bible he knew of and didn't know where it was found. He couldn't find it. So he ran off. Oh, there's so much more to say about judgment. I'm going to have to get to it next week. And next week, I will be joined by one of my new co-hosts, Dana Wright. We'll go through this. We'll see if Dana has some questions or comments about judgment. And then we're going to have a very interesting discussion about Barack Obama. You see, Dana voted for Obama in the last election. I did not. But Dana's experiencing what they call buyer's remorse, and she'll tell you about it next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.